These are my recollections of Turner Ashby, memories of the years when the oceans rose and the several states were separated asunder. One, although I'm often asked about the early days of the separate states, or as I like to say, the ephemeral nations, it's a rarer occasion that I'm prodded to discuss what I remember best or perhaps most personally about those seminal years of the early 30s, when the acute shiftings of the world's trade winds and the advanced meltings of the Arctic's ice flows collided with truly significant political upheaval in a society that was decidedly digitized. I've written extensively on the collapse, takeover, and final dissolution of the United States federal government and the tax indentures that followed. I pride myself on the fact that I can still summon a fairly detailed account of the embryonic and rather vicious politics of those early and fractured days of the 20s and 2030s. And I would stress that there was most definitely a before and an after to the summer of 2031. The world was never to be the same. That summer, the oceans rose 4 feet in a month, 17 feet over a 2-year period. The price of beef cattle, precious metals, and soybeans rose 10, 20, 100, finally 500-fold. The United States of America finally shattered into a motley list of 53 august and dispirited nations, one of which was the Commonwealth of Virginia. My nation, I suppose, to have and to hold, Virginians have always been rather sentimental towards their state's rights. That summer, I was 16 years old, going on 17. And that summer was much like any other summer for a 16-year-old, if you squinted, stuck a dead fish up your nose, and tossed your computer across the floor. There was a swirling madness to that summer, but I can't say it was the threat of standing ankle-deep in the swelling waters of the James River, or the threat of being sent to Texas to work off my family's tax debts that made me truly realize that the world was capable of being a crushing and capricious monster. No, that was left up to the day that Lays Fitzgerald kissed me goodbye. She brushed my cheek so lightly with the back of her fingers, and she tried to smile. I leaned close, so close our foreheads touched. Her hand in mine, she pulled my hand to her breast, and I would have promised her anything a 16-year-old could promise. I was certain that we would never see each other again. Of course, with hindsight, I realized that Lays and I were always saying goodbye. That was a pattern, the most consistent and recognizable pattern of our lives. And each goodbye was always just as sweet and just as devastating as the very first. Lays and I had been schoolmates half our lives. Ours was one of the last classes, educated entirely in the public sector and educated on physical school grounds as opposed to sitting in front of the ubiquitous thumb screens. My father, who was a judge and had been a federal appellate judge at that, insisted. He held the quaint notion that there was a common thread and inherent goodness to educating the common man's progeny among his own in a building with halls and bricks, musty radiators, and even books. He'd been shot once, gunned down in the busy corner of his own dear city of Richmond for those beliefs. Luckily, my father was wearing Kevlar body armor, most federal employees did in those days. A little warm and snug in the Virginia heat, but he was spared. My father, the Honorable Warwick Ashby, was what the politicos of that era called a neo-federalist, as if he was being accused of being in cahoots with Alexander Hamilton himself. The names of James Madison, George Mason, Thomas Paine were often bandied about to settle or start just about any political argument. The idea, it seemed to me, at my tender age, was there was a firm belief that if you talked about the government, especially the federal government, and you talked about it long enough and said enough nasty things about it, it would simply give up and disappear. And it did. Lays and I were the children of an ignoble and endangered species, bureaucrats. My father and Lays' father, Frederick Fitzgerald, everybody knew him as Freddie, were acquaintances. They were bound together by the simple fact that they had sworn to uphold the Constitution and do their jobs. That my father was a judge and Liz's father was the head of the United States Internal Revenue Service's Mid-Atlantic Division, in other words, he was a tax collector, made these two men paramount to the devil in the Free State's eyes. And so on that day of our goodbye, on July 12th, 2031, it was a minty day. Once or twice a week, the city, most cities in the United States, sprayed to freshen the air. It was perhaps not absolutely necessary, but it wasn't a bad thing. The air was often foul, and that week it was minty. Sometimes they sprayed with musk, sometimes with watermelon. Ladies like minty best. I preferred cinnamon myself. And so, in that goodbye of July 12th, Liz was being sent to her aunt and cousins in Chicago, of all places, to be secure, to be removed from the rabble, to be on higher ground because hell and high water were lapping at the door. Now, I have no idea, even now, why no one thought or called ahead to consider whether Chicago would most likely be under just as much water as the cities of New York, Boston, or Philadelphia. Maybe yes, maybe no. Reliable eyewitness information was hard to come by that summer, and panic was in the air. And as usual with panic, decisions were made, made quickly, and then just as quickly reversed. They argue all the time, Liz had said of her parents. Her mother and father were not natives of Virginia, and that had its own new and unique set of face share entries and problems. As the various states declared their various independences, borders closed, IDs and DNA profiles were checked, airspace was secured. God knows you wouldn't want a West Virginian crossing it over into Kentucky without the proper go-ahead and credentials. How the hell you tell them apart, I still don't know. Heading cross-country at that time was a bit of a dubious prospect at best. Liz certainly was not going to be able to fly, even though her parents were willing to pay, and pay dearly. Still too expensive, too risky. Only true millionaires owned their own planes and flew anymore. Public carriers were long gone. Trains were out. There were reports of submerged tracks locally all up and down the old privatized Amtrak lines between Richmond and Washington, D.C. And who could possibly guess if you even got a westbound train, would it make it over the rivers, through the tunnels, and across those cornfields all the way to Chicago? Now, automobiles were a slight possibility, but they didn't go as far as they once did. Half of them anymore simply littered the roads after the fuel seizures of 2025. Trucks and long haulers, of course, still ran, but cars sat alone on the major arteries, highways, interstates, back roads. People had begun to live in their old cars, spent their lives in those cars, had babies in those cars. So you could get in a car, that wasn't a problem. Just wouldn't go anywhere close to Chicago. That, oddly enough, left buses. Buses had fallen out of favor long, long ago, but had made a comeback along with outrider ATVs with shotguns and automatic weapons to offer some protection. It was quite a sight, probably like watching a stagecoach out of the old West giddy up out of town. And that is where ladies kissed me, the newly refurbished Virginia Google Jefferson Davis Memorial Bus Terminal down off Williamsburg Road. She was boarding an old non-refurbished Greyhound bus. It was such a new, streamlined mode of transportation. It was just like the 1950s, so I'm told. I'll always know where you are, I told Liz. How, Turner, how will you know that? She whispered to me. You got a chip in your head, I said. We all got chips in our head, she said, except your chip is bent from that fall you had as a baby. This was the way our banter went. Most kids had something similar, silly and foolish, to say to each other. But we did have chips in our heads, that much is true. It was a bio-digital implant, tiny little things sent behind one's left eye that hooked your optic nerve up to about everything. The iCloud, the Everse, to your homework, to the stock markets, and especially games. Course games. We all love games, of course. I remember I must have been in third grade when I got my chip stung. It was much more mechanical, electrical, than biological. Basically, it was a router. The chip could be assigned a number of different tasks remotely and get and store information remotely from a number of remote locations. It worked well. I actually have no idea how it worked. They were given out free to school systems, workplaces, and especially churches. The idea that you could have the Bible floating around your head was a preacher's delight. But the true muscle and gristle behind all those implants were financial institutions who, for our safety, for the safety of their money, imagine, wanted to know what we were up to and to tell us what to be up to in case we had no opinion about it. These banks, of course, were then owned and were greatly influenced by social networking concerns. There were about three social networks, huge things. It was to their advantage to tell us what to buy and how to think. Certainly can't leave that kind of thing in the hands or the brains of the individual. It was well-designed, extremely well-marketed, tight little package. I say that in hindsight, having no idea at the time how tight the package truly was. So we did have all kinds of information, all manner of information coming to us. Just didn't know anything. We had chips in our heads, and we still didn't know anything. That summer of 2031, we certainly didn't know anything for sure. For instance, we did not know if North Carolina would attack. We did not know if Texas would continue to demand that other now independent states honor their FDIs. That was a federal deficit indentures. This is where a family contracted the labor of a healthy family member for a number of years to work off their tax debt, which had been privatized from the federal rolls and sold 12 years earlier. There were also IDIs, there was international deficit indentures as well, but I'm getting ahead of myself, I suppose. I suppose I'm always getting ahead of myself. And we did not know how much of the Arctic ice sheet was left to melt. We did not know if the Chinese had bolted into Siberia or what they would do with the place if they took it. We knew very little. We did not know if the bus would leave on time, but it did. And that's when Lays left me. She let go of my hand. I can still feel her fingers slip away. That moment remains one of the most sorrowful and romantic brushes with a woman I've ever had. She picked up her suitcase. She nodded to her mother. She kissed her sister. I could stay, Lays pleaded, and tears in her eyes. I could stay and fill sandbags, just like everybody else. We've discussed this, her mother said. You'll be fine. You'll be safe. That's the important thing. Lays boarded the bus, along with a lot of other children. I hate to say children. I hardly consider Lays a child, but many parents were loading up their kids and sending them all for relations. Through one of the smudged windows, I saw the Covington twins, Eddie and Dwayne. They were our age. I never liked them. They looked like a photograph from a different era. They looked haunted. Their older brother, Rayford, was one of the outriders. Should have known. The bus rumbled off straight west, headed over the mountains, away from the rising seas. We were, Lays and myself, children born into a world of vast absurdity. More recollections later. Turner Ashby.